Jr. and several Trump allies, including Florida Congressmember Matt Gaetz, former Fox News host Tucker Carlson. Protesters gathered outside the Salvadoran embassy in Washington, D.C. to call out the Biden administration's recognition of what they called an illegal and unconstitutional second term for Bukele.
We know that your government knows of the kidnapping and deaths of our children and families in Bukele's jails. President Biden, it shames us that your government decided to participate in the inauguration of a new dictator in El Salvador.
For more, we go to San Salvador, where we're joined by Roman Gracier, a French-American journalist reporter with El Faro English, covering Central American politics. His latest piece for El Faro English is headlined, Biden and Trump Camps Jockey for Favor in Bukele's New El Salvador. El Faro's editorial board also recently published an op-ed titled, A Dictatorship is Born. So, Roman Gracier, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain the significance of this inauguration, the second term of Bukele, who describes himself as the coolest dictator.
Hi, Amy. Hi, Juan. It's great to be back with you. Well, as you noted in the introduction to this segment, this is essentially the evolution or the fulfillment of a process that's been developing at least since 2021. When the constitutional chamber and the attorney general were removed in the first day of the last legislature, when Bukele's party had achieved a supermajority in the elections. So they removed the constitutional court or chamber, which then dramatically reversed course just 3-4 months later, I believe in September of that year, ruling despite 6 articles of the constitution that Bukele could seek re-election. So that was essentially the first stepping stone. And the following year, he declared that he would indeed run for re-election. And late last October, just minutes before the enrollment deadline as a candidate, he did indeed register as a candidate for re-election without resistance from the Supreme Electoral Tribunal or other institutions. And on February 3rd, he was re-elected with over 80% of public support. And he was just sworn in on Saturday.
And Roman, if you could explain to our viewers and listeners why Bukele has such deep support among so many Salvadorans.
Well, I think it has to do with a number of factors. First and foremost, being the state of exception, which, while it has been very repressive, as you had also identified in the introduction, does hold the strongest support among the in the electorate and in polling. We saw throughout the election that the government, in fact, did not do very much campaigning at all. The president did not do very much campaigning at all. It was more of there weren't future looking proposals such as we want to do this or that. It was more a victory lap, stressing the reduction of gang presence, the dramatic reduction of gang presence in communities across the country. And there were even ads being run prior to the election suggesting that if the opposition, quote, were to return to power, then there would be a dramatic unleashing of gangs from the prisons. And this could only be avoided if the president's majority in the legislature were to continue.
And could you talk about the Bukele government's crackdown on journalists and human rights defenders? You yourself were among a group of journalists who were surveilled by the Bukele government with the Pegasus spyware?
That's right. At the time in late 2022, when we announced the Pegasus surveillance, extensive Pegasus surveillance of El Faro, there were also multiple other newsrooms who were touched by that, as well as human rights organizations, columnists. It was very extensive. And I would suspect that if more people were to subject their phones to the same test that we ran, we would have an even broader picture of what that surveillance truly looked like. But the digital surveillance certainly has been strong. The context of in-person and digital intimidation has also been very ever present. Just a few days before, 2 days before inauguration, if I'm not mistaken, the government announced arrests against 9 historic FMLN leaders, accusing them of plotting to plant bombs throughout the Capitol. And the audio that the police posted online didn't speak of that. And in those terms, it spoke of a product that could not fail, et cetera. And one legal aid organization that knows the defendants asserted that this, that they were speaking of firecrackers that are often used at protests. So the broader context, the undertones of inauguration have been very tense, hostile at times. And at inauguration itself, there were snipers on the rooftop, on rooftops close to the event, the military checking people who are coming in and out. So the whole context definitely had militaristic undertones to it.
Roman, as we begin to wrap up, you've got Bukele detaining over 80,000 people since 2022, many without charge, in his so-called war on gangs. You have the Biden administration just 3 years ago, officials refusing to meet with President Bukele in D.C., given the human rights abuses or his tendency toward authoritarianism. Now you have a high-level delegation led by Mayorkas being present at the inauguration, and you have the right wing there. You have Florida Congress member Matt Gaetz. You have Tucker Carlson, the former Fox News host. And you have Donald Trump Jr. clearly representing Donald Trump. Why? What are their interests?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting to see these what appeared to be parallel U.S. delegations at inauguration on Saturday. On one hand, you have the Biden administration, who, after the initial ruling by the Constitutional Court, actually even before that, after the removal of the last Constitutional Court in May 2021, they were extremely critical, as were most of the countries in the hemisphere, or many of the countries in the hemisphere. And that posture gradually changed. So by the next year, actually even adding one more step to the picture, when interim U.S. Ambassador Jean Mayes left the country in around November 2021, the U.S. by that time had compared Bukele's ambition to seek re-election to Hugo Chavez. And she left the country saying that she believed she didn't have a partner in the country at that time. So the criticism was very broad. But by the following year, what Juan Gonzalez and the other Juan Gonzalez, the former national security advisor to Joe Biden, told El Faro English was that in a public setting was that sorry, my computer just turned off on me.
You're fine.
Okay, well, then I'll just keep talking. So what Juan Gonzalez essentially said in a public forum the following year was that, you know, there are different interpretations of the Constitution, and we'll let the people decide. And at that point, things were more ambiguous. And by this year, the administration has settled into a posture of steering clear of the question of unconstitutional re-election and focusing on efforts to draw closer to the Bukele administration. I think part of that has to do with the fact that when the current U.S. ambassador was faced his Senate hearing, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stressed that I believe this is a direct quote. He said, "We don't have to applaud everything that they're doing, but there is a national security interest that should also be balanced." So I believe that's what is afoot on the side of the Biden administration. And as for the Trump orbit, there is Bukele was very close to the Trump administration and to U.S. Ambassador Ronald Johnson, who was there. There was an extensive cooperation on migration, the efforts to stop migration to the U.S. and Mexico border. And in recent months, you could say in the past year, as things have been particularly delicate with the Biden administration, and there was a lot of uncertainty as to the tenor of the relationship, Bukele was very openly courting the U.S. far right. He was meeting with Tucker Carlson on his show, taking other steps, and it was very evident that there was a mutual affinity. And basically, the visit by Donald Trump Jr. confirmed it was the most public sign of what had been understood for some time, which is that Bukele does, in fact, bet on and support the return candidacy of Donald Trump in November.
And finally, Matt Gaetz has described Bukele as an inspiration to the Western world, the man who describes himself as the cool world's coolest dictator. Roman Gressier, I want to thank you for being with us. Reporter with El Faro English, covering Central American politics, joining us from San Salvador. This is Democracy Now! We turn now to major election results out of Mexico, where Claudia Sheinbaum has made history as the country's first woman and first Jewish person elected president of Mexico. Sheinbaum is a climate scientist, former mayor of Mexico City. She's a member of the ruling Morena Party and a close ally of the Mexican president, AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's been credited with lifting millions of Mexicans out of poverty. Preliminary results show Sheinbaum easily defeated her closest rival, trounced her, Xochitl Gálvez. Sheinbaum addressed supporters Sunday in Mexico City.
No llego sola. Llegamos todas.
I didn't get here on my own. We, women, all got here together. Our female heroes who created the nation, our female ancestors, our mothers, our daughters, our granddaughters. I congratulate all the Mexicans that, by participating in the election, demonstrated that Mexico is a democratic country with peaceful elections.
Mexico's election was marred by terrible violence. At least 38 candidates were assassinated during the campaign. Meanwhile, to the north, President Biden is expected to sign an executive order today that would temporarily shut down the U.S.-Mexico border after asylum requests made by migrants surpassed 2,500 a day. Mexico's cooperation key in enforcing the measure, as migrants blocked from entering the U.S. will be forced to wait in Mexico. For more, we go to Mexico City, where we're joined by Laura Carlson, director of the Mexico City-based international relations think tank MIRA, Feminisms and Democracies. Laura, welcome back to Democracy Now! The significance of Sheinbaum's victory, the first woman president, and what this means in Mexico and in terms of U.S.-Mexican relations.
The big news, of course, Amy, is that Mexico has its first woman president. After 200 years of democracy and 65 male presidents, the populace elected a woman for the first time with an overwhelming majority. Now, this is more than a symbolic victory. What it means is that there's an example for younger women that women can be leaders, that they can gain the support of the population, and they offer greater horizons for younger women as they begin to think about their own futures. It also means, and I've been talking to women from other countries, for example, in Chile, with Michelle Bachelet as president two terms, and also in Honduras, Xiomara Castro, that there's a number of doors that open for women's equality and policies that have to do with women's equality. For one thing, there's usually greater dialogue. There are more channels of dialogue. For another, there's the support that women presidents can give each other, especially within this region, in terms of promoting gender equality policies across the region. These could be a path toward greater gender equality, and which is obviously very key to democracy within the region. Now, in the clip that you played, Claudia Sheinbaum credited women before her with her victory. And it's very important to recognize this. She owes a lot to women's movements within Mexico. Women's movements in Mexico began fighting decades ago for gender parity and equal representation in political positions within the country. And it has not been an easy fight. We're talking about a country with a traditionally macho culture, which has now achieved a landmark in democracy that even the United States has not achieved. They began by requiring quotas in candidacies. They would get a legislation passed, and then the parties would find loopholes. They would have to close up the loopholes. They began to push for laws against political violence, gender-based violence, that would disqualify or even threaten women for being women. And little by little, they made this progress until, also with the support of Claudia Sheinbaum's party and the Morena, they achieved parity in the cabinet and within Congress at certain points in the recent history. So all this was very important for her arriving. Now, the current government has not had a good relationship with women's movements. Women's movements have been dissatisfied, particularly with the lack of progress on the key issue of gender violence. We saw massive demonstrations of over a million people throughout Mexico on March 8th, International Women's Day, protesting against the lack of progress and what they see as relative indifference of the government toward women's demands to reduce it and protect them. And in fact, the president has been dismissive and at times even attributed their criticisms to a manipulation of the right wing. There's a expectation that the relationship will be different with Claudia Sheinbaum. The current government does have feminists who are involved in it. There's an expectation that feminists will join this government as well, and that there may be new policies to direct the issue of gender-based violence. Femicide in Mexico is very high. It's kind of hard to pin down the numbers because it has a different legal definition in different entities. One of the things that she's proposing is that there be a federal definition of femicide and that it be a crime that's prioritized for prosecution. Contributing with groups of lawyers for women who denounce crimes of gender-based violence. There's a series of proposals, most of which are fairly similar to what's been in place before. So women are looking to see a more aggressive policy. However, there is an expectation that there will be some changes here, and particularly in the tone. Claudia Sheinbaum is a very different type of politician from Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He was obviously the wind in her political sails. To be able to achieve a victory, which is a 30-point margin, it's greater than even most of the polls assumed. She's winning by the latest figures, which is over 95% of the vote counted, by 59% to 28% to her closest rival, another woman candidate, which is interesting, from the right, Xochitl Galvez, as you mentioned. And so his popularity, which has been consistently above 60% throughout his six-year period, significantly contributed to her win, as well as the popularity of his programs. These programs, which are called the Fourth Transformation, which means the fourth moment of significant change in the history of Mexico, from independence, the reform, and the revolution, giving it this historic dimension, are really based on social programs where a majority of Mexican families are receiving benefits from the government, and that was reflected as well in the vote. So she's promised to continue to that with that. And one of the big debates is how much will she create her own mark on this presidency. Mexican presidents have a great deal of power, which means that former presidents typically fade into the background, but there's some question about how much she'll be able to do that. She's, of course, insinuated that this kind of a question is sexist, which you could definitely see it that way, and has said that she has a commitment because there's a public mandate to continue with these policies, but that she will indeed be her own person.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Laura, and ask you to stay with us because we're going to do an interview with you in Spanish after the show and post it at democracynow.org on our Spanish website. Laura Carlson, director of the Mexico City-based international relations think tank MIRA, Feminisms and Democracy, speaking to us from Mexico City. Next up, we go to the head of Save the Children U.S. about Israel's war on Gaza that's killed 15,000 children. Back in 20 seconds.
Que las flores no te falten en el pecho, que se funda tu nariz en el país, que los lunes no se llenen de un cruel duelo, que la tierra te sostenga en tu raíz, que te duermas sin deberle la justicia a las madres que ahora buscan por ahí a sus hijas entre fosas clandestinas. Que resista la esperanza de vivir. No te olvides de tus ojos de mujer. No te olvides de tu boca de mujer.
Compañera Presidenta by Mexican musician Vivir Quintana. The song was released last week in honor of the first woman president of Mexico. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at Israel's war on Gaza and its impact on Palestinian children. More than 15,000 Palestinian children have been killed over the past 8 months, and Palestinian officials are warning over 3,500 children are at risk of death due to starvation. We're joined now by Yanti Sirypto, the president and CEO of Save the Children U.S. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You and other CEO and presidents of major human rights and humanitarian organizations and NGOs have written an op-ed. Talk about what you are calling for, Yanti.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me. And yes, we wrote that op-ed in December for the New York Times, essentially calling out the risk of what we see happening now. Casualties, deaths at a massive, massive scale, particularly of children, which in our view are avoidable if there was a ceasefire. And we have called on that for months and months now, ceasefire for all parties to adhere, to release hostages, and to allow aid to come in at a massive scale.
And Yanti, when you spoke at the United Nations in April, you said that more children have been killed in this conflict than have been killed in all armed conflicts globally over the past 4 years. Is it your sense that the world community is acting at a speed that necessary for what's going on here?
No, looking at the results on the ground, clearly that is not the case. We see, and sometimes these numbers, I think, numb people, right? Because behind every number is a child or its parents, the community, the family that loses that child. And we've always said for months now, put yourselves in the shoes of those parents, of those, you know, innocent civilians who are caught up in this conflict, and imagine that it was your child, your cousin, your grandchild that was exposed to this level of trauma, let alone death. And sometimes that makes people remember their humanity. But if you look at the actions on the ground, even over these past couple of weeks, it has even gotten worse. I was in Gaza myself 8 weeks ago, and I saw, sadly, exactly what I expected to see: scores of children, huge undernutrition, malnutrition, children without shoes, children without a home, people sleeping in tents, often with 20 or 30 people at a time, no access to clean water, a real issue, health issues abound, children with rashes, coughing, fevers, pneumonia, etc. So, And it's gotten worse since. When I was there 8 weeks ago, not nearly enough trucks made it in. I think we were about 150 or so a day. Over the last couple of weeks, it trickled because of the closure, even of the few crossings that were open. And then there are areas within the Gaza Strip that have had no aid supplies whatsoever for the last for these last past months.
I wanted to ask you, we've seen all of the protests at American universities and schools and the repression as these students have sought to raise the issue of what's happening in Palestine. But could you remind our viewers and listeners what the education situation is like in Gaza, what the school situation for many of these young people, for all of the young people of Gaza is right now?
Right. So children have been out of school since the start of this conflict. We estimate, I mean, we don't know the exact numbers, of course, because it's so hard to get people on the ground, but we estimate that over 80% of schools are either damaged or completely destroyed. What's left of some of these schools are actually populated by people who are displaced. So there is no way schools can function at this point in Gaza. Save the Children has been running where we can do so safely, learning spaces, child-friendly spaces, as we call them, where children can be children, they play, they learn. But clearly, this is not even close to resembling, a formal education system. We're many, many months behind that.
So what specifically are you calling for, Yanti Sirypto, as you sit there in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.? What are you demanding of the Biden administration at this point? As you say, this is unprecedented, not to mention the 15,000 children dead, 3,500 facing death by starvation, even if they don't die, how they're affected for the rest of their lives.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are numbers that are estimating that 17,000 children have lost their parents or at least one parent. So, no, the trauma is unimaginable. We've been calling 4 months now for a ceasefire, for all parties to adhere to it, for the violence to stop, and then for allowing massive aid to come in to flood Gaza, to make sure people get access to clean water, to food, to shelter, and every other, you know, basic supplies in order to start rebuilding their lives, and for humanitarian workers to be able to do their work safely and securely.
Yanti Sirypto, I also want to ask you about your recent trip to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where over 7 million people have been forced from their homes, one of the world's largest displacement crises. Can you talk about what Save the Children is calling for there now and what you found?
Well, first and foremost, and that's partially why I traveled, attention for the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It is a vast country, a country that contains multitudes. So, as you say, one of the largest displacement crisis in the world today, over 7 million people displaced. Huge conflict, particularly in the east of the country, with scores of armed groups and international armies fighting, which displaces people and puts people at risk. And at the same time, unbelievable wealth of resources, critical for our energy transition for the world, the lungs of Africa, as it's called, and it's also one of the biggest carbon sinks in the world. So the DRC should play a much more important, critical role for the international community, and it should get attention and the support its population deserves.
And briefly, what do you think Washington could do right now in terms of what's going on in the Congo?
Support the peace process. There has to be peace in the DRC to really have sustainable development and support for its population, in particular, the many, many millions of children. Support the peace process that's running. Make sure men with guns come to the table and agree that this is no way to support this this great country. And then really put funding behind the work in Congo. Currently, the humanitarian resource plan for the DRC is funded, I think, by 17%. So 17% of the required funding, that's an estimation of the United Nations, is currently funded. So that gives you a sense of how big the gap is between what is needed and what we actually have. I was visiting an IDP camp there in the east last week, and Save the Children was literally the only humanitarian organization in that particular camp of 20,000 people who were displaced, who was actively providing some services there. And that is really a rare sight to see.
An IDP camp is an internally displaced persons camp. I want to end with your Twitter thread. You said, firstly, we're all more connected to the DRC than we realize. The country holds over 70% of the world's cobalt supply, a mineral used in virtually all batteries, including cell phones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Just an interesting note to end on. Yanti Sirypto, we thank you so much for being with us, President and CEO of Save the Children U.S. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Felstein, Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Asti, Gio Rabi, Karen Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. Our podcasts are available where you get your podcasts, both video and audio podcasts, and you can go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, we're Young Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft. Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.